Welcome to the Royal College of General Practitioners Essential Knowledge Update podcast. My name is Sally Higginbottom and today I'm interviewing Dr. Matthew Castledon about the new NICE guidance on referral for suspected cancer. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
So can you tell us a bit about the background? Why have NICE produced guidance in this area?
Well, we all know cancer's such a big issue for primary care and it's essentially a growing problem in the UK as in much of the rest of the world. So what we now know is that the lifetime risk of cancer for someone born after 1960 is 1 in 2, whereas it's 1 in 3 for people born after 1930. And the sort of UK background essentially is that we're not doing very well in terms of cancer survival statistics compared to the rest of Western Europe, where we're below average. And at the same time, we know that at the practice level, there's a lot of variation, unexpected variation in terms of early referral for cancer, even when age and other population characteristics are taken into account. So there's been a big push to improve early diagnosis of cancer and reduce the variation, and that's the context for the NICE guidance.
I see, and have they changed the referral thresholds?
So yeah, so part of this is that the referral threshold has been changed and tightened. So previously it varied depending on the cancer. It was around a 5% positive predictive value, that's the number of true positives over the number that at test, in other words, the ones that we refer for cancer. And it's been tightened, so now 3% BPV. This means that 3 out of 100 patients that we refer according to the guidance would be expected to have cancer.
I see, so we're going to be referring more people under this new guidance.
Essentially, yes, we're referring more people, expecting that only 3 out of 100 of them will have cancer. But basically, to pick up the ones that do have cancer, we need to refer a lot of extras.
And how do you explain that to a patient who, as soon as you say, I'm going to refer you on an urgent pathway or a 2-week wait pathway with cancer at the top of the form, is going to be understandably very anxious? Have you found any good ways of explaining this to patients?
I think the best way is to sort of turn it around, essentially. So, and the guidance is clear, we need to inform people that we're referring them on a suspected cancer pathway, and obviously ethically we're obliged to do that. But with this tighter threshold, it means that 97 out of 100 people we refer shouldn't have cancer. And if you explain it like that, that should be quite reassuring to people. The vast majority of people that we refer on a cancer referral pathway won't and shouldn't have cancer. But to pick up cancers early in the people that do, we need to refer all these extra people.
I see. I think that might be a good way, the 97% rather than the 3%. So obviously there's a long list of specific criteria for each cancer area, but what things in the guidance surprised you or might represent a change in practice?
Well, it's a long, complex document and there's a lot of changes in there, so it's quite hard to pick out particular things. In fact, almost every cancer type, there's an update compared to the previous 2005 guideline. I mean, there's one or two things. I'll be looking more closely at high platelet counts as thrombocytosis appears among the referral criteria for at least a couple of cancer types for lung and endometrial cancer. So if you get a high platelet result on a result, it's worth investigating a bit further. I suppose staying with lung cancer, in terms of the way the language has changed in the guideline, there's a good example there. It says that unexplained hemoptysis in patients over 40 is a reason to refer urgently, regardless of the chest x-ray findings. Whereas before, it would say persistent hemoptysis. So now it's just unexplained, regardless of how long it's been present.
I see. So that those are tightenings, as you say. And I don't think it would have occurred to me in thrombocytosis that might be a particular endometrial cancer. I'm not sure that would have occurred to me before. So that's quite a helpful hint, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's same to me, actually. I sort of think of thrombocytosis as being maybe an acute phase marker, but not necessarily cancer-specific. So, yes, it's something that I'll do as well.
Yeah, okay. And how about the non-specific cancer symptoms? Have you encountered that situation clinically at all?
Well, I think we've all had that patient who just doesn't seem to be right, who's sort of systemically unwell, but there's nothing very clear. But the guideline is quite specific. Three particular non-site-specific symptoms we're supposed to look at, and it's unexplained weight loss, appetite loss, and DVT that should be considered symptoms of concern for cancer. I think the problem is, without additional information, we don't know where to refer them, and there's no separate non-site-specific cancer referral pathway. So that section, I think, is really just serving as a reminder that we should be looking harder at these patients, taking a more detailed history, being quicker to investigate if we do have concerns rather than just adopting a watchful waiting policy.
Yes, I mean, with these patients, I always kind of hope they're old enough for the elderly medicine docs to see, because otherwise we get a bit stuck, don't we, if we can't find a particular path to go down and they're under the age of 75 or whatever your local area cutoff is, and then it's quite hard to find a general medic or someone who can take a good look at the whole patient for you.
Yes, I think that's the problem, and the guideline doesn't completely answer that problem essentially, but it's sort of urging us to keep trying and keep looking essentially.
Okay, I see faecal-occult blood testing is back in. Now, I seem to remember we'd sort of stopped doing that other than as part of the bowel screening. Have you got access to FOB testing locally?
Well, the short answer is I'm not sure. Yes, our local laboratory withdrew it in 2011 because at that stage, and I think that's the case in a lot of other labs around the country, that the evidence seemed to be going against it as a diagnostic test. Obviously, it remains a screening test. And that's been quite controversial, I think. Various specialists that have said that that's doesn't agree with their understanding of the situation, and there's some correspondence in the BMJ about it. I think it's one of those places where there is uncertainty still, despite the guideline being published. We're obviously constrained by what's available locally, and we all have to watch this space, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's my view too. It's interesting because patients have got used to doing the test, often patients who are in the national screening programme. So actually perhaps the test is more patient acceptable than it used to be, but the jury is still out on how useful it is, particularly how useful a negative result is as going forwards. And I was also interested in the comments about children's cancers. This occurred to me when I was uploading all the forms to our practice system the other day, and I don't think I've ever referred a child on a two-week wait. It would seem bizarre to suspect cancer in a child and not just phone your local paediatrician and get them seen today, really. I don't know what your thoughts were.
Yes, I wonder if this is another area of the guideline where it's more sort of flagging up, think cancer essentially, because you're absolutely right. I think I'd be the same. You're either faced with a child who's acutely unwell, you know, if there's an underlying malignancy and they're decompensating, then obviously you're going to be referring them in much quicker than 2 weeks. Otherwise, you're dealing with children who are essentially well. I suppose you might want to consider, you know, x-raying a limb, if there's bone pain, to look for an osteosarcoma, but I can't think of a lot of situations, I completely agree, where you would think there's a reasonable likelihood of cancer and you'd want to do a two-week referral. I think it's more of a flag, you know, think cancer even in children, although it's extremely rare, it does happen occasionally, and I think often, you know, parents' experiences have been that because GPs know that it's very rare, that there has been a delay in maybe doing necessary tests and looking a bit further.
Sure, and I think it's rare in children, but it also presents oddly, doesn't it? As you say, it can be very, very non-specific symptoms or unusual tumours, so it does need to be borne in mind so that we don't miss it, because we'll see so few in our careers, won't we, thankfully.
Yes, quite.
I've seen those very colourful sort of spiderweb diagrams which are supposed to help us make decisions. What are your views? Have you found those helpful in practice?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I haven't used them directly, but they sort of come in because of this, you know, big change in the new guideline is this third section which organises all the recommendations according to symptom presentation rather than by cancer type. And I think in theory that's a big advantage of the new guideline, that we've now got a symptom-based approach to checking guidance, but it's a very long, complicated document, and those spider diagrams are a way of getting them all together in the one page, or 3 pages, I think, it's about as good as they can get. So although I don't know that many GPs would find them useful actually within consultations initially, it's a way that you can sort of find a pathway through the guidance according to patient symptom presentation. And I think they will be useful for doing audits or case reviews retrospectively, certainly.
Yes, I think it's interesting. I think most experienced GPs just don't think in a linear flowchart way, actually, which is always a problem for people designing the guidelines that kind of think that we do. If we're going down to a risk of 3%, then really we're saying, if you think that cancer is a plausible explanation for this patient's symptoms, you should be referring on a two-week wait, and it's dropped it right down to, you know, if it's somewhere sensible on your differential, you should consider referring, I'd have thought, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's the problem when it comes down to quite low levels. As you say, the positive predictive value, you know, we're trained as GPs to have that gatekeeper role very much in mind, and you know, the movement in terms of cancer diagnosis is starting to push against that, essentially. I don't think there's an easy way out of that dilemma. There's so much information that anything that makes it a bit easier to get a hold of the problem is to be looked at. And some people think visually and the spider webs diagrams will work well for them. There are also tables that have the nice recommendations of listed in a tabular format. The Cancer Research UK do a good infographic, which is a bit different from the BMJ flowcharts. So yes, there's a little mini cottage industry in how to present this new guidance in an accessible way, and it's worth shopping around a bit. And actually, the original guideline itself is relatively easy to read, and the new section is worth a look, even just to skim through and pick bits out, as it were, rather than trying to digest it all at once.
That's helpful. And are there any particular take-home points for busy GPs you'd like us to remember from this module?
It is that new section, the symptom-based recommendations, that's sort of the very new thing about this guideline. It's such a big document, it's impossible to take it on board all at once. But I think, you know, it's relatively easy to do a symptom-based case review informally, just looking at cases that you've seen presenting with particular symptoms, and then looking up those symptoms on that third section of the new guideline, and you know, ask yourself, what would I have done, and does that match up with the new recommendations? Or doing a more formal audit, again using that section of the guideline. And then we can sort of chip away at it over time. And you know, I think there's a resource implications in this guideline as well that local laboratories and radiology departments haven't caught up with yet. So it's going to take some time to bring it all on board, and we don't have to do it all at once.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Thank you for listening to this essential knowledge update from the Royal College of General Practitioners.